starting at, I believe, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, whenever it begins, at democracynow.org. A very happy birthday to Edith Penty. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wells, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamer Yao Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Dennis Moynihan, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Graham, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Oregon's COVID-19 vaccine rollout continues as the first known case of the so-called UK variant is discovered in the state. A Clackamas County commissioner apologizes after racist post on Facebook. And tomorrow is Inauguration Day. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 19th, 2021. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The Oregon Health Authority reported 666 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing the state's total number of confirmed and presumptive cases up to 133,851. Oregon health officials also reported three new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 1,803 people. Multnomah County had the highest number of new cases with 140, followed by Washington County with 87, Lane County with 81, and Marion County with 79 cases. The Oregon Health Authority reported 342 people hospitalized statewide with COVID-19, including 94 patients in intensive care units. The first case of the UK variant COVID-19 strain, which is thought to spread 50% faster than the original, has been discovered in Oregon. The case was detected during routine screening of staff at the University of Portland. The variant has a mutation that makes it easier for the virus to lock onto the human cells that they invade. Some models show it could become the dominant form of the coronavirus in as little as 6 to 7 weeks. Multnomah County Health Officer Dr. Jennifer Vines said that while it is the first known case in Oregon, it's likely not the only one. More than 8,400 doses of a coronavirus vaccine were administered on Sunday. In total, about 217,000 doses of the vaccine have already been administered in Oregon, less than two-thirds of the vaccinations that have been delivered statewide. State officials also announced that the vaccine rollout to some groups would be delayed after a shipment of 200,000 doses from the Federal Reserve failed to materialize. Governor Kate Brown said on Friday that Oregon will start vaccinations of teachers on Monday, January 25th. However, instead of opening vaccinations to all residents ages 65 and older, as Brown had said just days earlier, older Oregonians will be eligible to get vaccinated in a phased rollout. All Oregonians over the age of 80 will be able to get their first dose of the vaccine starting February 8th, followed by ages 75 and over on February 15th, 70 and over on February 22nd, and 65 and over beginning March 1st. The change in the vaccination schedule comes after officials learned that Oregon would not receive 225,000 more vaccine doses from the federal government. U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar had promised to release the federal government's entire supply of vaccines rather than holding second dose shots in reserve. However, states have learned that the additional doses are not coming because the U.S. stockpile does not exist. The federal government had already shipped out its second doses. Brown said, quote, "I am shocked and appalled that the federal government would set an expectation on which they could not deliver, with such grave consequences." Oregon is also expecting to receive $38 million in federal stimulus money to help fund its COVID-19 vaccine rollout. The $38 million is part of the $3 billion for states approved by Congress that went into law in late December. OHA said the money will be used to track, distribute, and administer the vaccines, as well as for public outreach promoting the vaccination. Only a portion of the $38 million will be distributed to the state this week. The stimulus bill also provides $243 million to Oregon for COVID-19 testing, contact tracing, surveillance, and containment efforts. A Clackamas County commissioner has apologized after making racist posts on Facebook. On Tuesday, Clackamas County Commissioner Mark Schull apologized during a press conference in a room full of religious leaders from across the metro area. Schull's apology comes just days after the county district attorney and local legislators, among others, called for Schull's resignation. He refused, choosing instead to apologize and meet with local leaders. Schull, who was sworn in last week, has been under significant pressure to resign after the Clackamas Review first reported on a series of comments he posted to Facebook in 2019 and 2020 attacking Muslims, immigrants, people who are transgender, and the Black Lives Matter movement. The full Clackamas County Board of Commissioners voted in favor of a resolution on Thursday calling for his resignation, though Schull has refused. Schull said, quote, "I accept full responsibility for every word that ever came out of my mouth. With humility and sincerity, I ask for the good people of the Muslim community to consider my request for forgiveness." Schull did not take questions from the media. When asked by local pastor Matt Hines to say Black Lives Matter, Schull responded, quote, "All lives matter." Over the course of the nearly two-hour press conference, Schull did not address the transphobic statements he made or offer an apology to LGBTQ community members. Tomorrow is Inauguration Day, and Joe Biden will be sworn in as President of the United States. For more, here's KBOO's Al Khan.
Tomorrow at the stroke of noon Eastern Standard Time, Joe Biden will be sworn in as the 46th President of the United States, putting an end to an administration that has been one of the most controversial in the history of our nation. This inauguration, however, will be quite different from those of the past. For one, people are being asked to stay home and watch the televised broadcast and not flood the D.C. area due to concerns from both COVID and security after the attack on the Capitol building on January 6th by right-wing insurgents. Those that are expected to be in attendance are most members of Congress and the Supreme Court, as well as former Presidents Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton, along with former First Ladies Michelle Obama, Laura Bush, and Hillary Clinton. Former President and First Lady Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter have sent their best wishes but will not be in attendance. Also not in attendance will be Donald Trump, marking him as the only president not to attend his successor's inauguration since Andrew Johnson in 1869. The Vice President Mike Pence will be present. Biden will be sworn in as traditional by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, and will take the oath of office on his family's heirloom Bible, which will be held by his wife, Dr. Jill Biden. After the swearing in, Biden will address the nation with a speech that is expected to be centered on uniting the country, which was a central theme in his campaign. He is also expected to speak on the national health crisis of COVID-19 and lay out his plans for dealing with the many other issues that the country is currently facing. For KBOO News, I'm Al Kahn.
President-elect Joe Biden will deliver his inaugural address tomorrow as the nation still processes the Capitol riots. An expert on these speeches says Biden could provide some healing by staying with his theme of unity and reminding voters, especially those opposed to his win, that democracy plays a bigger role than his agenda. Mike Moen has more on the story with the Public News Service.
As Joe Biden assumes office this week, he'll appeal to a nation facing multiple crises. But a Wisconsin professor who studies presidential speeches says Wednesday's inauguration could be a launching point for promoting a resilient democracy, not just the person taking over. Biden has tried to focus on unity in light of a contentious election in which President Donald Trump issued discredited claims about voter fraud. That led to his supporters storming the Capitol, along with polls indicating many Republicans still not acknowledging Biden's win. The University of Wisconsin's Allison Prash says Biden could establish some healing by sticking with unity and restoring faith in democracy and not putting attention on himself.
He is a spokesperson for democracy, but he is not the definition of what our democracy is.
She says that compares with Trump's rhetoric of one person being the focal point of government. Beyond the inauguration, Prash says Biden's actions in this area could help cement some healing. She adds that he could also win over support by staying honest about the state of the pandemic, the economic struggles facing many Americans, and the need for accountability related to the riots. Prash says past presidents, such as Thomas Jefferson and John F. Kennedy, emphasized a shared national identity when facing partisan divides, resulting in some success in healing. She says even though some voters won't accept Biden as the winner, a president's words still matter for all of the electorate.
The president sets a rhetorical example. They set the tone for other political discourse.
She says a tone that's focused on unity could trickle down to lower levels of government. She suggests that could benefit states such as Wisconsin, which has divided leadership in state government, as well as areas that have strongly supported Trump and others that condemn his rhetoric. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
Joe Biden has selected Dr. Rachel Levine as Assistant Health Secretary. If approved, Levine will be the first out transgender Senate-confirmed federal official. Levine is currently the Pennsylvania Health Secretary and a pediatrics and psychiatry professor at Penn State College of Medicine. She served as the state's Physician General in 2015 and Assistant Health Secretary in 2017. Throughout her career, Levine has written about the opioid crisis, LGBTQ medicine, medical marijuana, eating disorders, and adolescent medicine. She graduated from Harvard College and the Tulane University School of Medicine and completed her training in pediatrics and adolescent medicine at the Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York City. Biden said in a statement, quote, Dr. Rachel Levine will bring the steady leadership and essential expertise we need to get people through this pandemic, no matter their zip code, race, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability, and meet the public health needs of our country in this critical moment and beyond. Levine joins other Biden administration nominees who would make history if confirmed, including California Attorney General Javier Becerra, who would be the first Latino to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, and South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who would be the first Senate-confirmed LGBTQ cabinet member as Secretary of Transportation. A bill in the Washington State Legislature would extend Medicaid coverage for mothers from 60 days after birth to 1 year. The bill passed in 2020, but was vetoed because of budget concerns due to the pandemic. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Many women in Washington state are losing health care shortly after giving birth, a crucial time in a mother's life. Senate Bill 5068 would extend postpartum Medicaid coverage from 60 days to 1 year. The same measure was a victim of the pandemic in 2020. It passed with nearly unanimous support in the House and Senate, but was vetoed by Governor Jay Inslee because of budget concerns. Sam Hatzenbieler with the Economic Opportunity Institute says the bill would help address the maternal health crisis.
Right now, about 10,000 women are falling through the cracks because of income or immigration restrictions.
Washington State's Maternal Mortality Review Panel found 30% of all pregnancy-related maternal deaths occur 43 days to a year after birth. The bill has a public hearing in the Senate Committee on Health and Long-Term Care on Wednesday. About 700 women in the U.S. die each year from pregnancy-related conditions. Hatzenbieler says conditions such as anxiety and depression are a concern for recent mothers, and rates are higher among women of color and low-income women. She says SB 5068 especially would help Native American women.
American Indian and Alaska Native women are 6 to 7 times more likely to die from a pregnancy-related cause as white women. So this is a really, really crucial step that Washington legislators can take right now.
Hatzenbieler says the pandemic, which has hit people of color hard, is exacerbating these disparities. She adds that extending health care coverage would ensure that Washington families are getting the best start possible.
The best gift we can give to a child is to make sure that their mother is there to celebrate their first birthday and to raise them. And too many women are being lost to preventable health conditions.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Oregon Department of Corrections treatment of prisoners with mental illness. Karen James speaks with Disability Rights Oregon Deputy Legal Director Tom Stenson about his new report, 4 years later, Oregon Prison Overhauls Treatment of Inmates with Serious Mental Illness. Then at 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. And at 7, Sojourner Truth Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 34 degrees. Tomorrow will again be cloudy with a high of 46 degrees. Today in history, in 1809, poet, author, and literary critic Edgar Allan Poe is born in Boston, Massachusetts. Poe was the first well-known American writer to earn a living through writing alone, resulting in a financially difficult life and career. He is best known for his poetry and short stories, particularly his tales of mystery and horror. The quote of the day is from Edgar Allan Poe, who said, quote, "Those who dream by day are cognizant of many things which escape those who dream only by night." Trump is expected to issue around 100 pardons and commutations on his last full day in office. Plus, voting rights legislation is introduced in Congress that could expand access to voting and reduce partisan gerrymandering. With more on the story, it's Laura Rosbrow-Tellum with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we track the transition in uncharted territory. President-elect Joe Biden loaded boxes of food to honor Martin Luther King Day yesterday. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris also volunteered. President Donald Trump issued 3 executive orders, one to make permits easier for judges, prosecutors, and law enforcement officers to carry concealed firearms. Another rather ambiguously protects Americans from facing criminal punishment for unintentionally violating regulations. And a garden with statues of heroes, which needs congressional sign-off. Trump's expected to issue scores of pardons and commutations in the final hours of his presidency, but not so far for his family and himself, according to Fox News. The Biden-Harris inauguration is expected to be light on in-person public attendance tomorrow and heavy on security. Biden's expected to quickly issue dozens of executive orders himself, many to reinstate policies from the last administration, including canceling the Keystone XL pipeline permit. Before attention is on Trump's Senate impeachment trial, Maria Teresa Kumar, head of the Voto Latino Foundation, wants voting rights to stay front and center.
People are going to try to restrict voting. What we want to make sure is that we create uniform methods of voting across the board and so that it's clearly defined and clearly accessible.
Kumar spoke at a recent National Task Force on Election Crises media briefing. She emphasized the need to stop many of the voter suppression practices seen in the last election and reduce the influence of big money in politics.
There's already talk of H.R. 1, which is the modernization of elections that the last Congress passed.
H.R. 1, the For the People Act, was just reintroduced. It passed the House in 2019, but lost then in the Senate. Chirag Baines from Demos details provisions to expand voting rights.
It would require automatic voter registration so that if you're interacting with government through your DMV or by requesting public benefits, that you also get registered to vote in that process. And that's automated, moving the burden from the individual to the government.
H.R. 1 would prohibit voter purges, adds Baines, require the option of online and same-day registration so you can still register on election day, and also replace partisan gerrymandering with nonpartisan commissions to draw electoral districts. A big job. Now that the 2020 census is done, redistricting will start. Yesterday, the U.S. Census Bureau Director Stephen Dillingham announced his resignation. He faced criticism for pressuring statisticians to document the number of people in the U.S. illegally. Sandra Chen at the Princeton Gerrymandering Project analyzes voter data to show where gerrymandering likely occurred.
There are a couple of states that particularly stand out from the last cycle because they actually created a situation of minority rule where the party that won a minority of the statewide vote share won a majority of the statewide seats in the legislature.
She highlights North Carolina, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Virginia. Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Ross-Brautelum. Thanks for listening.
As one of his first acts as president, Joe Biden is expected to shut down further construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. KBOO's Al Kahn has more.
It is expected that President-elect Joe Biden, as one of his first actions as president, will be to cancel the permits to the Keystone XL pipeline, according to sources close to the incoming administration. The $9 billion pipeline, which would move tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada to Nebraska, was halted in 2017 when President Obama vetoed the funding for the project. However, once Trump moved into the Oval Office, he immediately took action to revive the construction. Although there are already 2.6 million miles of oil and gas pipelines operating in the United States, the Keystone project has its own concerns, as it would carry tar sands oil, which is significantly different from conventional crude oil, as it is thicker and much more caustic, and spills are much more difficult to clean up, especially in water. Another concern of tar sands pipelines is the temperature at which they operate. Studies have shown that pipeline spills are directly tied to the temperatures at which they flow due to external corrosion, with lines that run with temperatures of over 100 degrees Fahrenheit 23 times more likely to rupture, causing a spill. According to a State Department environmental impact study, the Keystone pipeline would operate at between 130 and 150 degrees. Though the prospect of the Keystone project's shutdown is being applauded by environmental groups, there already has been some pushback from the far right. An article from Fox News claims that the cancellation of the project would affect approximately 11,000 construction jobs. Though at this time it is not certain how Biden will address the loss of these particular jobs, he has announced a clean energy infrastructure plan that has the goal of achieving zero emissions by 2050. This trillion-dollar plan is designed to create millions of jobs in the auto industry, as well as in construction and the power sector. For KBOO News, I'm Al Kahn.
The Navajo Nation First Lady hosts a human trafficking awareness event, and the Cheyenne River Sioux chairman urges the next president to honor treaties. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation Office of the First and Second Lady is hosting an event Tuesday to address human trafficking and exploitation. Fafilia Nez is First Lady of the Navajo Nation.
We are hosting a virtual event just on the topic of human trafficking. And just to really give, it's almost like a human trafficking 101 virtual event, just to give the very basic information to community members about what it is and how to kind of spot, you know, some of the things that you can look for within either your own family, your nieces, nephews, or within your own communities when you go out to different places or even into border towns for doing shopping or anything like that. You know, some of the things, these things happen around us, but we don't necessarily know what is going on because we don't know what we're supposed to be looking for.
Presenters from the Global Center for Women and Justice, Navajo Law Enforcement, Health and Social Services, and state agency representatives from New Mexico and Arizona are expected to participate. The webinar is being streamed on YouTube on the Navajo Nation Office of the President's Communication Channel. As President-elect Joe Biden prepares to take office Wednesday, the leader of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe is urging the next administration to honor treaties and remember Native nations. Chairman Harold Frazier congratulated Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris in a video message Monday from the Cheyenne River Reservation in South Dakota, standing outside next to the tribal flag on a snowy, windy day.
Many times, us Indian people have been left behind. It's like driving a bus. It's our bus, we own that bus, but yet, us Indian people are always put in the back of the bus. It is time that we are in the front of that bus. Now we are driving our bus. So as we move forward, you move forward, your administration, I really hope that you consider and never forget the Indian people of this country. We were here first.
Frazier then honored Biden and Harris with a song of gratitude. Biden and Harris will take part in an inaugural event Tuesday night. A ceremony is being held in Washington, D.C. to remember the hundreds of thousands of Americans who died from COVID-19. The Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians in North Dakota is making its own hand sanitizer for distribution to the community after facing supply shortages during the pandemic. KFYR reports the tribe partnered with a company in Florida to develop the hand sanitizer. The tribe's expected to begin mass distribution in the next few months and will also be reaching out to others across the country in need of a supply, including other tribes. A camp has been set up next to construction of the Enbridge Line 3 project in Cloquet, Minnesota. KBGR-TV reports about 24 people set up the camp in opposition of the project. Indigenous-led movements have been taking place at various construction sites in northern Minnesota since work began in early December after state regulators approved the final permit for the pipeline replacement. Tribal and environmental groups are vowing not to give up fighting the project, saying it threatens water and the environment, while supporters of the project point to jobs and an economic boost. Some Minnesota tribes and environmental groups filed a lawsuit in December seeking to halt the project. Laura Waterman Whitstock, community leader, journalist, and co-founder of McGeezy Communications in Minneapolis, Minnesota, passed away over the weekend at age 83. She's being remembered for her decades-long work advocating for Native journalists, Native radio, and youth development. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 19th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Laura Rosbrow-Tellum, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. News and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Food Show, keeping you on top of the news and issues surrounding the food on your plate. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for an in-depth report on the Oregon Department of Corrections treatment of prisoners with mental illness.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Four years ago, Disability Rights Oregon found that adults in the Oregon Prison Mental Health Unit were subjected to staff violence, isolation, and received inadequate mental health care. At that time, the Oregon Department of Corrections agreed to improve treatment for adults in custody with severe mental illness. I'm speaking with Tom Stenson, Deputy Legal Director for Disability Rights Oregon, who just released a report on the progress made by the Oregon Department of Corrections as a result of that agreement. So, Tom, let's start with 4 years ago. At that time, Disability Rights Oregon released its report, Behind the 11th Door, that revealed the treatment of adults in custody with severe mental illness. So talk about some of the conditions that Disability Rights Oregon found in the Oregon prisons at that time.
At the time that we were doing the report, at the time we went to the Behavioral Health Unit, which is a unit within the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem, we found that there were a lot of people who were being left in their cells virtually 24 hours a day, very rarely getting out of their cells. That was the most common concern. And human beings aren't intended to spend all their time locked in a little room. And it's well accepted, widely known, that especially for somebody who starts out already having a serious mental illness, that locking them in a room for 23 or 24 hours a day for weeks or months, or in some cases years on end, is one of the worst things you can do to them. It makes their condition worse rather than better. Some psychiatrist groups have even called it a form of torture. It's a very negative practice that unfortunately is widely practiced within the United States. People are beginning to recognize how bad this is, but that was the most common factor. We found people who literally had not left their cells in months at all. Some of them hadn't gone out to take showers for months. And so what this created was the worst possible environment, not just for prisoners, but for the staff who worked with them, for the welfare of the public generally in Oregon, for the Department of Corrections and the state as a whole. This is unfortunately a common practice around the United States. As I've said, there are no advantages to it. It's a terrible way to manage this issue. And so what would happen is people who were seriously mentally ill, who were placed in these cells, they'd get worse and worse. They would have no outlet, no way to learn how to have a constructive social interaction with another human being because they were locked in a cell constantly. And for prisoners who had, for instance, delusions as part of their symptoms, being in a room by yourself, hearing only sort of weird echoey sounds from outside the cell, rather than a constructive, normal social interaction with another person, that tends to heighten and exacerbate delusions that somebody might have, that they're hearing voices, for instance. So people just get worse and worse and worse. And so the only way that they would have any interaction with the world is if they responded negatively, you know. And so they'd have some sort of minor disciplinary issue and, you know, the correctional officers who'd interact with them, these people were being presented as security issues, not as people who had a mental illness. There wasn't a lot of understanding about what it meant to have a mental illness among the security staff. And so they'd react very negatively to somebody, you know, who might be calling them names or something like that. And so they had this very sort of hard-nosed security-oriented response. And that would just create this cycle where prisoners didn't get any kind of supports or treatment that they needed. Their conditions would get worse. They'd act out in some way. Security staff would crack down on them which would continue to make this cycle worse, and that would make it even harder for them to get the supports that they need. They'd have more and more restrictions on them. It would be harder and harder to get out of their cells, or if they went out of their cells, they'd be not just shackled at the wrists, but they'd be shackled at the legs and in this sort of four-point restraint that really limits how they move around. And so it just kept creating this negative cycle that seemed to have no exit for anybody involved. It made the facility a really negative place to work for staff. It was pretty frustrating, I think, to the mental health staff who were trying to work with the prisoners. It meant that assaults, both staff on prisoners, prisoners on staff, prisoners on prisoners, were very common in all directions. So that was the status of things when we wrote that report.
Tom, it's hard to believe that you are describing the Oregon prison system only 4 years ago. These sound like conditions that would occur centuries ago. Another common practice that you found 4 years ago was traumatic cell extractions. And there were incidents of extreme self-harm.
So one of the ways that people who are in extreme psychiatric distress, who are in extreme crisis, express that is through acts of self-harm and attempts at suicide. That's a measure of really heightened psychiatric stress on somebody who has a serious mental illness, that they will attempt to harm themselves. And that was something that we saw inside the BHU, that there were people who had long histories of multiple acts of attempting to hurt themselves, whether it's by cutting themselves or hitting their head against the wall. And again, this continued to be treated mostly as a security issue when we were first doing the survey. And so the response was not to evaluate what does this person need? What kind of treatment does this person need? Why are they doing this? You know, it was treated as a security issue. And so the response that would often happen is that a number of correctional officers would suit up in full body armor for what's called a cell extraction, which is how security staff remove people from a cell when the person doesn't come out on their own. This is another thing that just created this sort of endless cycle, that a core part of this problem was that people were never allowed out of their cell. They weren't given constructive things to do. And then if the only time that somebody leaves their cell is to be sort of dragged out by heavily armored correctional officers, they're not going to have very good feelings about going out of their cell. And that was what we saw when we arrived, was that several people that we interviewed had so much anxiety about going out of their cells that they were legitimately frightened of going out of the 8x12 cell that they lived their lives in, because when they went out, they had these really negative physical interactions, and prisoners would get injured. Sometimes corrections officers would get injured. And because it continued to be treated as a security problem, it heightened the divisions between corrections officers and prisoners. It increased the sense that these prisoners are dangerous or assaultive or, you know, non-cooperative among the security staff, and heightened this really negative cycle. And we were finding that these cell extractions were happening very frequently, very violently, and that it was sort of the, for many prisoners in the behavioral health unit, it was how they interacted with correctional staff. One of the most common ways they interacted with correctional staff.
So at that time, then 4 years ago, the Oregon Department of Corrections agreed to sign a memorandum of understanding with Disability Rights Oregon or face litigation. Disability Rights Oregon has been monitoring the progress made over these last 4 years, and your report just released, called 4 years Later, Oregon Prison Overhauls Treatment of Inmates with Serious Mental Illness, talks about some of the improvements that have been made over these last 4 years. So what improvements were made, Tom, and what do these improvements mean for adults in custody with serious mental illness and the workers at the prisons?
So there have been a lot of changes, and some of them are very tangible and physical. Some of them are more about teaching and understanding more about how things work. This is part of a national effort to eliminate the isolation of people with mental illness. And the isolation seems to be one of the core parts of this process to attack, one of the things that we most need to focus on. Obviously, we want assaultive behavior to stop, for instance, but the isolation is really a core part of this concept. And so one of the primary things we look for is to have people get out of their cells and have these sort of structured interactions, to get exercise, to engage in treatment, to take classes, to model normal social interactions. That's probably the most important thing, is for them to learn to interact with other people in a constructive way, not as somebody who's shouting at them from outside their cell, not as somebody who's dragging them out, but to understand, you know, how to interact with other people in a normal way, in a constructive way. They needed to have that opportunity to be out of their cells, to be engaged in something, you know, even if it's as simple as playing a game of cards or getting some exercise in the exercise rooms that they have. That really, really transformed the overall well-being of people. And I think the most striking result of it was that correctional officers who'd been working on this unit for, in many cases, years, who had never seen some of these prisoners interact with them in sort of a constructive way to say, hi, hello, how are you? You know, they saw prisoners who'd been locked in their cells for months at a time, who'd been really seriously ill, that the correctional officers had treated as an object of fear and security concern, that now they could have somebody come out of their cell on their own and they'd say, hi, how are you?
They saw them as individuals and human beings that had feelings and were intelligent and just had a mental illness that needed treatment.
Not just that they saw them as different people, but they saw that when they were treated humanely, they could respond like other human beings, that they were not lashing out at them, they were not screaming at them, they weren't incoherent and delusional, that they responded when they were given more freedom, and giving somebody more freedom and treating them more like a human doesn't make their behavior worse or make you more vulnerable. It actually improves life for the correctional officer as well as for the prisoner. And now, you know, what used to be a really dark, dank place to live and work, I think morale is up, not just among prisoners, obviously, but among the people who work with them, among the behavioral health staff, among the correctional officers. And people who were stuck there for months or years on end have been able to move on, have really improved their conditions. They've been able to get treatment, and their conditions have improved substantially. There's a lot more work to do still.
Tom, let's talk about the work to be done still, because your report says that there is still concern about the use of solitary confinement in the Oregon prison system. First of all, how does Disability Rights Oregon define solitary confinement?
Sometimes you'll find in other correctional systems or in Oregon that correctional systems will try and define away isolation. Isolation is when someone is confined to a cell for more than 22 hours a day. That's pretty extreme isolation. I think many people who see movies think the vast majority of prisoners spend all their time inside their cells. That's not the general experience. So people who are in general population in most correctional settings have at least part of the day when they go out into a common day room and they can have these normal social interactions. They can go out onto an open air exercise yard. The people who we're talking about experience pretty extreme isolation, and they have very little to do, very little constructive engagement with other people, very little in the way of constructive activities to do. It's a really dangerous way to treat people. Extreme isolation is bad for everyone, but it's especially bad for people with serious mental illness. It's also extremely bad for young people. It's extremely bad for people with intellectual or developmental disabilities. And yet what you will find in prisons as well as jails around Oregon is that a large number of people within those isolation units, and sometimes they're called solitary confinement, sometimes they're called administrative segregation or disciplinary segregation. There's a lot of different terms, but basically if you're not getting out of your cell for the vast majority of your day, you're in some form of isolation. We see that the people who end up in isolation are people who have mental illnesses, people who have intellectual disabilities, people who have traumatic brain injuries. And Oregon's beginning to untangle that. And our big hope is that the success we had at the behavioral health unit inside the Oregon State Penitentiary will resonate throughout the state, and that other people will benefit as I think prisons will trend away from using isolation as their means of response to prisoners who are difficult or prisoners who have behavioral issues or prisoners that they don't know what to do with.
Speaking of resonating around the state, your report specifically mentions Two Rivers Correctional Institution in Umatilla, Oregon. So what exactly is the Oregon Department of Corrections doing to improve conditions in that prison? And talk about what some of the issues were at TRCI.
So we've been working on issues coming out of Two Rivers Correctional in Umatilla. At Two Rivers Correctional, there's a mental health unit, which is a little different from the behavioral health unit.
And what is the difference between the behavioral health unit and the mental health unit in the prison system?
Sure. So the behavioral health unit is not intended as a long-term place for people to be. The behavioral health unit is designed for people who are in pretty acute behavioral crisis. Ideally, the use that Oregon Corrections is putting it to is to stabilize people enough to step down to a less restrictive unit. The mental health unit at Two Rivers in Umatilla is for people who have some mental health diagnosis, who need additional care and services, and who, because of their illness, are not safe to be out in a general population unit, usually meaning that they'd be taken advantage of. I think that's the other thing that people lose sight of. In prisons, just as in the larger world, people who have mental illnesses are much more often the victims of violence and abuse than the perpetrators. So one of the functions of the mental health unit at TRCI is to house prisoners who would be too vulnerable to be in general population. So they do have a day room. They are allowed more time out into that day room, but they're still pretty isolated from the rest of the facility. And their freedoms are somewhat limited. We're trying to press DOC to work on getting people more access to services inside the mental health unit to make sure that people are being treated as people who have illnesses and not people who are security problems. And there's some danger that some people on the staff still haven't sort of internalized that message, that in fact, things will go easier and better for everybody involved if we treat somebody as a person with an illness that's addressable. We also had concern about the use of disciplinary segregation for people who are housed on the mental health unit. When we started working on the problems at TRCI, there were a lot of concerns about people going to disciplinary segregation where they got no services, they had nothing to do. They'd oftentimes remain isolated for a month or more, often for behaviors that were associated with their mental illness, including acts of self-harm. You know, people could go to disciplinary segregation for hurting themselves rather than to get treatment for somebody who's clearly having a very hard time. So we've been working with DOC to try and reduce those incidents to make sure that people are not going to disciplinary segregation for having a mental illness, essentially, or for having symptoms of a mental illness. That's a continuing effort. Some things have gotten better. Some things there still need a lot of work.
Tom, for someone who has a loved one in the prison system who has a mental illness, what can we on the outside do to help our loved one?
I think for anyone who has a loved one in prison, it is really important to one, be a social contact for them. They need that normal social interaction. You know, those calls on the phone, those visits, if you can make them. Obviously, visits are limited right now because of the coronavirus, but, you know, to make sure that people have those avenues for those normal visits, they can really help ground somebody who's struggling. The second thing is to be a good advocate for your friend or loved one. If somebody suddenly changes their medication or puts them in isolation or transfers them into a unit where they're not safe, there's a good and a constructive way to be an advocate for your loved one to make sure that they don't fall through the cracks and to make sure that they get connected with resources that can help them. So I think those are the two most important things that someone who has a loved one with a mental illness in custody can do.
How has the pandemic affected a federally mandated advocacy organization such as Disability Rights Oregon? How has that affected access?
So we have had to shift our monitoring to a different route. You know, we are maintaining contact with people through letters and calls. Obviously, we can't go into the prison. So that is a challenge, and it's one we've been trying to respond to for the last almost a year now to make sure that we can still be an effective monitoring agency, given our limitations on in-person visits. It's also been an enormous challenge because some of the things we're most concerned about, like isolation, have been heightened by COVID. There's a really tough balance to strike between isolating people for quarantine purposes in a way that's going to keep them from getting sick versus isolating them in a way that's going to make their, you know, their underlying illness work. And I don't know that anybody's found a magic option, but it has been really stressful for people. It's also been really tough. You know, earlier this year, we had all the fires. There were people shifted, you know, from three different facilities around the state, and that was really stressful for people who were already isolating because of COVID. So it has just been an indescribably tough year all around. And, you know, the numbers for COVID infections are just getting worse as we speak. I think we're up to 2,500 out of about 14,000. That's a rough number. I don't have the exact numbers right at hand, but the number of people who've gotten sick is just enormous. It is very hard to maintain any kind of social distancing inside a correctional facility.
And Tom, while your report says that the Oregon Department of Corrections has made significant improvements, they still have not fully complied with the Memorandum of Understanding of 4 years ago, this agreement with Disability Rights Oregon. So have they avoided litigation? I know you'll continue to monitor the conditions in the prisons, but at what point would Disability Rights Oregon bring about litigation, especially for a continued solitary confinement of people, especially people with serious mental illness?
I certainly can't comment and say, here's what will, you know, make us file a lawsuit. Almost concurrent with our memorandum of understanding, the Oregon Department of Corrections brought in a respected national organization, the Vera Institute, to do a survey of how they were treating people in isolation. And the Vera Institute strongly recommended that corrections change their policies around isolation and to completely abolish the isolation of people with serious mental illness and to create other parameters to make sure that isolation was being used sparingly and not in a way that was going to hurt the most vulnerable people or create this cycle of violence and deprivation and illness. So far, corrections has had limited progress in regarding isolation outside the behavioral health unit, which is just one unit within the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. There's still a lot of people who are being housed in disciplinary segregation or in other isolating settings that I think are overused, that are causing harm to prisoners, and that are not constructive or helpful for the rest of the correctional system either. And we have continually challenged corrections to incorporate those recommendations and to reduce further the problem of isolation within correctional institutions. So far, we have not had further success on that issue. We're going to continue to advocate for the elimination of isolation for people with serious mental illness and the reduction of isolation around Oregon corrections. whether any of that would result in litigation is not something I could say.
And we must stop incarcerating people with serious mental illness, especially those whose crime is a direct result of their illness. So what is Disability Rights Oregon doing to help divert people with mental illness away from prison?
So one of our most significant initiatives is we want to eliminate the criminalization of mental illness. What we find all across the state is that there's overwhelmingly a lack of mental health resources. And so obviously people who are seriously ill, who are going untreated, the lack of treatment is going to make them worse off. So in some cases, we do see that there are obvious connections between a lack of treatment and bad outcomes for people with mental illness in the criminal justice system. But even more so, we see there are a lot of communities in Oregon where someone's not just incidentally arrested because of some product of their mental illness, but they're intentionally arrested just because they have a mental illness. There are a lot of communities in Oregon where criminal justice authorities feel there are so few resources that they rely on arresting people who are doing nothing more than being mentally ill in public. They intentionally use the criminal justice system as a way to address that. Rather than getting people the care that they need, they say, well, we don't know what else to do with that person. So just arrest them and put them in jail. So we find people all over the state who are arrested for disorderly conduct. You know, they're walking down the street and talking to themselves. And somebody will be concerned and they'll call the police because that may be the only option. You know, if they're concerned and they want a police officer to check and make sure that somebody's doing okay. Well, if you send a police officer to somebody who's having a mental health crisis or symptoms of their mental illness, that police officer doesn't have any ability to treat them. And so some police officers say, well, I'll find something to arrest them for. And it's oftentimes these petty little offenses like disorderly conduct or, you know, criminal trespass because somebody goes to a gas station because it's a warm, dry place to be and the store owners told them to leave and, you know, they don't know what else to do, or maybe they're in the middle of a crisis and they don't understand. And then they get arrested for some misdemeanor criminal trespass. We've had people who have tried to reach out for help and called 911, or they're in a crisis and they think somebody's after them and they call 911, so they get arrested and charged for misusing 911.
So what further recommendations do you have for the Oregon Department of Corrections?
Well, just as on the outside, there continues to be a security response to people experiencing mental illness. And so there needs to be a greater inquiry when somebody's charged with an offense inside the jail. Jails have their own disciplinary processes. And sometimes when somebody disobeys an order, or, you know, somebody tells somebody to go over here or go back in your cell. Obviously, for somebody who doesn't have a mental illness, they may not be obeying your order, you know, because they're willfully deciding not to do so. But for somebody who has a mental illness, who may be struggling with the symptoms of their illness, they may not obey the order because they don't understand it or because there's a lot going on in their head right now and it's hard for them to understand or obey, or they may have some fear about going over there and doing what the officers asked them to do. And so what we continue to see is that people who have serious mental illnesses are charged with offenses like disobeying an order, not with punching somebody in the face, but with these sort of procedural problems inside the correctional system. And so we want a greater level of inquiry in those sort of technical violations to make sure that those aren't the product of some sort of illness, and to make sure that those are not the bread and butter of disciplinary action, isolation of people in disciplinary segregation. And that's a particular area where we've struggled with corrections. There's still very strong evidence that people who are being disciplined and going to isolation, that it's because of these sort of technical violations. It's not because they punched somebody in the face. It's because they didn't obey an order, or they were disrespectful, or those are overwhelmingly statistically what we see.
And I'm speaking with Tom Stinson, Deputy Legal Director of Disability Rights Oregon. And Tom, where can people find your report?
It's behind the 11th door, and we have a series of follow-up reports on our success. You can go to droregon.org. That's our website, and you can check it out for yourself.
Again, I've been speaking with Tom Stinson, Deputy Legal Director of Disability Rights Oregon. For KBOO News, I'm Karen James.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's